Oh, baby, we so back.
Whoa.
Look who it is. The prodigal son returns.
That's right. A voice for sore ears.
Special guest alert.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're joined today by a guest, special guest, friend of the pod, Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been on a lot of episodes, and we're glad to have him back.
Yeah, we're glad to have him back again to provide some insight and discuss this book with us. You know, it's always good to have you when you can be here, Paul.
Thank you guys for allowing me to come back. It's always an honor to be here. I'm excited to get things rolling again.
Yeah.
You've been so generous with your time, and I appreciate that it's back.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys have had a couple of successful episodes without me, and I figure I'm just so honored.
Well, we only did one without you, though. The last one with Ben.
Oh, yeah, true. But I'm honored to be back in the chair.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could call him a bench warmer.
That's comedy.
Yeah.
But yeah, Paul's back. He's been crushing life, and now we're ready to roll. This is our second episode recording in 2 days.
Yes.
Yeah. A bang bang.
We're doing it for you. We're doing it for the people. And you know, just because we want to make you happy, give you the good discussion.
Yeah, we love you and we're concerned for you, and we want to give you a glimmer of something to look forward to in your probably otherwise miserable life.
Boring life.
And today,
if you like the show, by the way, new listener, you can go to patreon.com/spinecrackers where we post the full episodes, because we end the normal episode after about an hour or so, and then we talk about more stuff, take listener questions, you know, reveal the inner secrets of our private lives in the Patreon segment and gossip. So
it's after the paywall, it's all for sale.
Yeah, exactly, baby.
Yeah.
Did you guys do listener questions last night?
Yeah, but we only got a couple.
Okay.
And I don't know if we have any yet tonight, so.
Well, it's only been one day, so.
Well, ask the people, and after the course of this discussion, this hour or so, perhaps we'll have some interesting queries to A.
Right. Yeah. Okay, hold on. I'm just going to post in the Discord.
And just for everyone's, personal information today, we're going to talk about Chess Story by Stefan Zweig.
I say Zweig, yeah.
Yeah, that's my attempt at doing it right. I don't know if it is. Stefan Zweig.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Steven Zweig.
Stevie Z.
I don't know if this positioning is going to work out.
Paul's on the floor, everybody.
On the floor
for the listeners.
Through this podcast, and my back already hurts.
He's doing an exercise in stoicism as we speak.
Yeah.
This is Zweig is an Austrian author, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who fled Germany after the Nazis took power. Him and his wife moved, I believe, first to New York and then to Brazil somewhere.
Yeah.
And then they both killed themselves.
Is that true?
Yeah. Trigger warning, a suicide.
At the same time?
Too late. They both killed themselves. They, I forget what the drug was. It's one of those like 1940s.
Pentobarbital.
Like weird drugs.
So was it an accident? It was an
overdose? No. They both overdosed. It was like a pact. They both overdosed on the drug on purpose and died.
Why? Were they like really bad at chess?
They lost one too many times.
I've been there before, so I kind of understand.
You do get tilted when you lose at chess.
I'm never going to play chess again in my life. I've decided.
Because you lost like twice.
Well, I lost to your brother in the dumbest way possible in a really intense game on the chess.com app years ago. And I was like, never again.
My brother's good. My brother's good at chess, to be fair.
Yeah, but I like totally should have beaten him in this one game. And I moved so stupidly, didn't see it. And he checkmated me. And I was like,
yeah,
kill myself or quit. So
that is how it goes. You make a mistake and lose. Get checkmated.
Make a mistake, lose, and then you don't learn. You just sort of go, I'm going to kill myself, or I guess I'll never touch the game. I'll never touch the game again. Yeah.
I think why they did it, I don't know. It's interesting. I mean,
It seems like a depression related thing.
Yes.
More so than anything else.
I mean, he was like, he kind of had a reputation, you know, as being like this generally kind of like affable, you know, positive guy. He was very much like, you know, he loved the old Europe and old European culture and Austria and sort of like the 20s in Europe and all that. Like he loved that. And he, you know, and then he saw it all go to fucking shit because of the Nazis. And I think he was just like, fuck this, dude. Fuck the world, bro.
He probably saw some people he knew die too.
Yeah, certainly.
Do you know who went first? Did he do it and then his wife?
I think they probably just both took it at the same time. I don't know. I don't know the details.
Damn.
And his wife was actually his former secretary, I think. And she was a lot younger than him. I forget her name off the top of my head.
Scandalous.
Yeah. So he died in the early 40s, like 42, maybe. Yeah.
Well, okay.
So he was not even 60.
It's kind of shocking to me because I feel like the book did have kind of a positive, like, bouncy vibe.
Yeah, he was a positive guy, I think, in general.
Like Robin Williams type figure then.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That's a good comparison,
you know. And so, yeah, he wrote a lot too. He was very prolific, you know. He wrote a lot of nonfiction too. He wrote like a lot of biographies was one of his big things. So he was like, again, he just like liked the world that he sort of grew up in and the people, the kind of great men of his time.
Apparently he was one of the most popular and widely translated writers in the world.
He was very popular during his lifetime, yeah, but not so much later, which is interesting.
Huh.
I mean, probably the like sort of context and culture in which that reputation was being developed was, you know, shattered, I would guess.
Right.
What other books? I haven't looked up anything about this guy. What else did he write? Is this like, it can't be his most famous book, is it?
This is probably up there in terms of his more famous books. You know, I read, I've only read one other thing of his. It was another novella.
Checkers?
Yeah, it's called Checkers.
You had to work up to it, yeah.
Checkers story. No, it was called Confusion. And it was, that one was good. I think I made a video about it for the Patreon. I don't remember.
I think you did.
I think I did. And that one was good. That's also a short. This is very short, by the way. This is like 80 pages, like 83, 84 pages. And that one is also very short. And it's about a college student who kind of like develops like an intellectual crush on one of their professors. And they're confused by it, and they have a weird relationship, not necessarily sexual, you know.
Well, yeah,
it's about it's like the last book that we read, it's basically like agape, you know. It's like Greek intellectual love, fellow feeling,
sapiosexual.
Yeah, sapiosexual. Oh my god. Yeah, don't even run. That's my advice. If anyone tells you they're sapiosexual, people, run.
Yes. Yeah, so Zweig sort of, his reputation was like this sort of like gentleman par excellence, intellectual of like a Europe that he saw.
Classic man of letters.
Yeah, just get blown the fuck up. And I think it was like, I think he was a very sensitive man, prone to this kind of despair. And it was just a little bit too much. If he had hung in there for another 3 years, maybe he would have seen the light at the end of that tunnel, but it makes it all the more interesting. And I think Chestor is the most famous purely off of the strength of the text, but also like, you know, that intriguing fact of the final work before suicide.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if we mentioned that. Yeah. This was his final book. Yep.
Oh.
So I think this was my choice, right?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
I picked the last two cause I'm breaking the rules. No, I was trying to find short things for Paul to read cause Paul has been busy.
I have been busy,
but so I picked it partially for that.
That was such a lazy burp.
Wait, what?
Paul burped, but it was so quiet and lazy.
Oh, I didn't.
And it was like breathing.
I didn't burp. I said I didn't burp.
No. Okay. Never mind. I'm mistaken. I'm sorry.
The listeners will have to go back and review the audio.
Yeah.
Yeah. You really scrub it.
So I picked it A, partially because it was short, and B, because I really enjoyed Confusion, and I just kind of wanted to check out some more Zweig, you know, because he's not really, you know, I feel like he's not in that convo, you know. You hear like the hot writers, the big European writers of the war era. I feel like he doesn't get talked about a lot. I feel like he had, you know, like you said, he was famous, Matt, during his time and well translated and read, but I don't know if he was like critically respected in some ways, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about his bio or rep.
Yeah.
I know what he attempted to sort of cultivate for himself, but at the very least, he was a celebrity.
Yeah. So the plot of this short novella is there are the narrator, and we'll talk about this a lot. I think like Zweig does some really interesting stuff with narration and like perspective over the course of the, and sort of like who's talking and who we're hearing from, and you know, the way it's kind of like nested almost, it feels like. But our narrator is a psychologist, right? Who is on an ocean liner from New York to Buenos Aires, which is sort of parallels Zweig's own life. He moved from New York, not to Argentina, but to Brazil. So, you know, similar vibes. And Zweig was also, you know, talking about, like we said, he was sort of like a man of letters. He was also deeply interested in psychoanalysis. He had correspondence with Freud. I think that really, really, really comes through in this text as well, which we will get to. And he discovers through conversations with another passenger that the world chess champion is on board the ocean liner, a guy by the name of I don't know how to pronounce this, but like Sentovich. I think that's what I would go to. Yeah. Czentovic. So Sentovich, I would imagine. And
Before you keep going, wasn't he like, he was supposed to get an interview or with the world chess champion or something?
Well, he wants to, right? He wants to talk to him.
And that's kind of why he's on the boat, right?
No, I think it's just like chance.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, the him being on the same boat as Mirko Sentovich, the world
Mirko,
famous,
thank you, right.
Was just was like a coincidence, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You know, like the curious intellectual man of letters he is, he wants to meet the chess champion and perhaps even play a game with him, as anybody would, I think. That'd be pretty fucking cool. Oh, yeah. But you know, he learns that that Sentovich has kind of this reputation for being aloof and cold and doesn't really fuck with people. And you know, his background is he's basically a poor like farm kid, whose dad I think is like chewed up by a farm machine at some point when he's young.
Yeah.
And he's like basically he's a savant, right? He's like the classic idiot savant.
Yeah.
Who has no aptitude for anything intellectual or creative, other than he's really, really fucking good at chess, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which I thought was a good character, like even modern character. Because I mean, we were into chess pretty heavily during COVID times, and I was reading that section as like a pretty, I don't know how accurate it is, but I think there's a lot of chess players that are like that fall into that, like,
yeah,
this is the only thing that I'm good at type thing. And also, I am incredibly arrogant because I'm so good at chess. That's definitely a chess player vibe.
Oh yeah, well, who's that guy, the reigning champion or the
Magnus, well, you, this is
Magnus Carlsen.
This is drama, right? He's technically not the world champion anymore because he didn't retire, but he just didn't play in the, he didn't defend his title. He just said, "No, nah, I'm good."
Oh yeah, yeah.
But so, as an exemplar of like arrogance.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you look at that guy for like 1 minute and you're like, holy shit, he's so arrogant, it's crazy.
I like Magnus. I don't care.
He's a character. I mean, it's good for chess.
He's a character for sure. The current tactical world champion is Ding Li Ren.
Right.
Chinese player. But anyway, so yeah, I think the characterization is pretty on point, you know. Sort of like this you know, savant, autist chess player.
But also a capitalist too. Like he only, once he got to a certain level, he was like, yeah, my agent only allows me to play chess ever if I get money. So like
right.
when they're on the boat and they, the people want to start like, cause he meets like a, what, like some sort of tycoon character. That
yeah. Was- McConner is a Scottish businessman who made a fortune in California.
And he's really also on the boat. And, the world champion, I forgot his name already, says he only
Centovic
wants to, he'll only do it if he gets paid like $350 a game, which I think is like $2,000 or
yeah, that would be a lot of fucking money. I think it was $250 in 1941 dollars. It's got to be at least like a G, right? In today's money,
look it up on
chat. Yeah, go for it. But yeah, this guy, and like I think Centovic is like, he's also like, you know, yeah, he's this hyper intuitive kind of instinctive savant style player.
Yes.
From an incredibly destitute, poor background who ends up being.
And then like he lets his success kind of get to him, right? Turn him into a dick and a money, you know, he's sort of a cheap, you know, very interested in the money and the fame.
Yeah, he becomes sort of the servant boy of, I think, an aristocrat of some sort, who has like his weekly game with the constable or something, right. or a priest or something like that. And then Mirko finds his way to the table and then beats the pants off of both of them. And then they sort of start to sell his talent. And as any sort of like person from dirt poverty with no education, he's like this very insecure, but arrogant, like penny pincher.
Yeah. Once he gets the success.
Yeah, because you know, suddenly he's like,
I don't know if everybody from that type of background will be like that, but it's a type of character. Yeah.
Like, yeah, you know what I mean. Like one.
Don't generalize, Marl.
I'm not disparaging the.
I know. I'm fucking with you, dude. Did you find the conversion, Paul?
Oh yeah,
$4,665.
No shot.
$4,000.
Damn, that is a lot of money for a game of chess.
Yeah. Holy shit.
And they ended up playing like how many rounds of that? Like four?
Like the guy pays him a bunch of money to play. Yeah.
Yeah. The guy probably drops like 20 grand in current money.
Right. So McConner, right. So Centovic is on the thing, or the narrator tries to get him to talk to him, tries to find him, but he's like, doesn't even leave his room. It's very difficult to get in contact with him. And so the narrator sort of, he calls it a hunter's trap, right? He lays out a chessboard with his wife in the kind of sitting room bar area of the
he's using ship. Psychology.
Yeah, exactly. He's using psychology. Exactly. And sure enough, Centovic makes an appearance and, but swiftly looks at the board and leaves with the attitude of like, oh, these people are idiots. I don't need to bother. Well, even
ants.
Watching this game. Right.
And ants,
right?
Ants people. For me to crush, little bug idiots. And so then the narrator meets McConner, the Scottish businessman in California, and McConner finds out that Centovic is on board. And McConner is this, you could just picture him, he's characterized so well, just this big blustery red-faced Scotsman, you know, successful in business, and he's like, I have to play him.
Yeah.
And you know, he thinks probably he even has a chance at winning, right? He's just so full of himself. So they managed to set a game.
Well, they set up a bunch of games, right?
Well, yeah, but they you know, set up the first game, right? And they set it up as I forget what the term is. There's a term for it in chess. I think it's called a consultation game, where it's one person versus a group of other people. Right. Yeah. So it's Centovic versus McConner and the narrator and a number of the other passengers who are there. And of course he waxes them. Right. They lose swiftly and decisively. McConner, being McConner, instantly says, we're playing rematch.
Yeah.
You know, go again. Bad. It was bad RNG. My team sucks. you know, go. We got to go. We got to do it again. So they're in the midst of the second game, I believe, or it might be the third. I forget how many they played before Dr. B enters the picture. And they're losing again badly. McConner goes to make a move and a voice pops up from the back of the crowd Don't do it, you idiot. Don't make that move.
Yeah, that's what he wants.
That's exactly what he wants you to do. And this character is Dr. B is his name, and he helps the group work their way to a draw with Centovich, sort of saving a lost position to force a draw. This is impressive, obviously, and Dr. B sort of quickly slinks away, and the narrator is like, who is this guy, right? We got to figure out who Dr. B is. So the narrator goes and finds him, and they talk about Dr. B's past and how he learned to play chess. Oh, we should mention an interesting detail about Centovich is that one of the things that makes him unique among top level chess players is that he's famously unable to play the games by memory in his head, right? Which a lot of top level chess players do, right? They can just rattle off the moves to a game and kind of picture the board, you know, Queen's Gambit style in their head, right?
Right, yeah.
And Centovich is unable to do this. He has to have the board in front of him, and he can only play with the physical pieces present, right?
Which I actually am confused about why that mattered.
Well, it matters because Dr. B is exactly the opposite, right? So Dr. B can only
can't you assume that it's so unique in the upper level chess field that it would be like it's just a typical other chess player that how he thinks about the game? Like Dr. B is like normal.
Well, in terms of strong chess players, yeah, right? They can do what Dr. B does, but it's abnormal for Centovich to not be able to, you know, especially for the world champion, right?
True.
And then, it's this contrast with Dr. B, who, you know, he claims, I haven't touched a chessboard in 20 years, right?
Yeah.
Which is a puzzling claim because he's so good at chess. What do you mean you've not touched a chessboard in 20 years? Well, it turns out that Dr. B worked as a sort of accountant or sort of manager, asset manager for
he handled the money of some rich
for the Austrian nobility and elements of the church, and he helped ferret away some of their money and assets from the Nazis when the Nazis started to take over in Austria. And eventually it was captured by the Gestapo for it, right? Who wanted information out of him about the, kind of the loyalists in Austria and the church and all that and where all the shit was. But he wasn't tortured. He was put in a just an empty hotel room for months on end, right? And interrogated. Right. And this sort of slowly becomes its own form of torture, right? There's no stimulation, nothing to do, just an empty room all day with nothing. He manages to steal a book from one of the guards prior to one of his interrogations. And to his dismay, the book is just chess games notated, right?
Yeah.
No text, nothing to
so
read.
So boring.
Just the games, like the most boring fucking book you could possibly find. But then he goes on this journey of essentially memorizing all the books in the game front to back, playing them out in his head over and over. And then he's like, okay, well, now what do? I'm done with all the games. I know all the moves. And he starts to sort of play against himself in his mind, playing chess for months and months and months, right? And it's this very harrowing process that the way Zweig describes it, I thought was really brilliant.
Just a tea kettle boiling over, like, just, you know, a guy like, you know, and this comes up later, but like sort of putting himself, he's just a man divided,
right?
Essentially. And
he has his black self and his white self. With the chess pieces.
Yeah. He's sort of forced into like this like weird duality. And he sort of hits a state of frenzied mania that makes him kind of like pass out and eventually.
Yeah. And so he sort
of also allows him to basically get out of the cell and the interrogation routine.
Right.
They're kind of like, this guy's suddenly become so strong because he starts answering questions differently. And they basically release him because they think he's like,
they can't break him.
Strong and crazy. Yeah, they can't break him.
Well, I think the way he finally actually gets out is he has like an episode, right, where they have to send him to a medical facility.
Someone kind of saves him, like a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, a loyalist person who might even know, I think maybe knows who he is or who he's associated with, kind of like gives him the medical leave official note. Yeah,
not the concentration camp, but the interrogation hotel, I suppose. Right.
Yeah.
It's like the old like metropole or something in Russia.
Yeah, exactly. So he sort of swears off chess at that point, right? Because it was kind of driving him insane mentally, and then he encounters this Sentovich, and so the narrator tries to get him to play a game with Sentovich, which finally he is able to do. They play, and Dr. B wins the first game. And he had claimed, I'm only going to play one. If I play any more, I'm going to, you know, he's like an addict, right? I can only have one or else I'm going to go
gonna backslide. Yeah. I'm going to relapse.
But then he can't resist. And he starts to play a second game, and Sentovich kind of picks up psychologically on like, this guy's kind of a little off. Right. And so Sentovich goes out of his way to like play very, very slowly, takes the full time, like 20 minutes per move or whatever it is, 15 minutes per move. And Dr. B is just getting more and more agitated, like, come on, motherfucker, just move, because he's so used to playing so quickly in his own head against himself. And he sort of starts to lose it, and he declares a check because he's playing a separate game in his head against himself that does not actually exist on the board.
Kind of one of the cooler moments. It's not what's happening, bro.
Sentovich is like, I don't think I'm in check, man. And Dr. B resigns and you know, sort of seemingly swears chess off again, and that's the story. Nice. I know that sort of went on for a while, but it is a dense little novella. I think there's a lot packed in here.
Yeah, it's I mean, like the broadest first thing that like I picked up on was obviously like Gabe or Paul, you were saying like you know, why is it important? But like this kind of like dividing line, these like the duality of like, you know, two very distinct and kind of opposite ways of being and thinking or not thinking, like in combat with each other, like in the same medium.
Yeah.
Like the fact that Sentovich is so, like, he's so physically grounded. He's just this like, you know, kind of like calloused handed son of toil who like needs a physical chessboard in front of him in order to even play, because he's so incapable of like the intellectual element and the abstraction, you know, of being able to like play games in his head, versus somebody who didn't even have a board to begin with because they were in prison, who's so in their head and so over intellectualizing it that they actually like go nuts. And I think it's also significant that, you know, in lieu of like the ascendant like Nazi regime, that the kind of blood and soil people, you know, symbolically win and like come out on top in that contest, where the intellectual class works itself into a frenzy and is thus ineffective against just the sort of like more physical grounded powerful force of somebody playing off of pure instinct and willing to like kind of torture you and, you know, take those intellectual weaknesses as like strategic points to manipulate and take advantage of.
Yeah. When I read it, when I read it and read the characterization of, I'm not going to remember his name, the world champion guy.
Sentovich.
Yeah, I was like, this is unrealistic. I'm sorry, but that would not happen. The world champion would not play chess that way.
So why?
Because it's like, that's not how it works. In my head, what I know about chess is like, it'd be absolutely wild for like the top player in the world to not be able to visualize a game.
I think we got to give some artistic license here. At the least.
Yeah. I know, I couldn't.
And... Well, and but I mean, to be fair to Zweig, right, it is unusual, right? It is weird. And he makes a point about saying that, right? Everyone is like, this is so weird that someone is this good at chess but can't conceptualize it. They have to see the pieces, you know.
And I think I was trying to like pick up on the metaphors of what that could mean, like guy who is tortured by, you know, the Gestapo can visualize and beats and goes through hell and beats the world champion who is from the lower class but can't visualize and is the world champ. I just, like, to me, I just, like, couldn't see a clear metaphor. And I feel like small books that are concise and compact should, like, not should, but, like, in my experience, usually do have very clear, direct metaphors that are, like, to the point. And I was like, I don't know the point of this story. That was kind of my vibe throughout the whole thing and the end. I was like, what just happened? I don't get what I'm trying to, well, I don't really understand what I'm trying to, what I'm supposed to get from this. Other than I finished reading it and I was like, this is just a cute little story, huh?
Yes, that was about chess. It's a chess story.
Cute little chess story. Okay.
And then he kills himself because of how cute it was.
Afterwards. That's, this guy, this chess book man killed himself.
Chess book man. Well, I mean, so for me, I think the metaphor is sort of, I wouldn't say it's straightforward, but I don't know. I feel like what I picked up on was basically, I mean, it's clearly about the Nazis, right?
Yeah.
And I think that was what was in the forefront of, like, Zweig's mind. And, like, notably, this book is really the only time he, like, takes that up, right? He wrote a bunch of stuff during that era, but this is his only book that sort of addresses it, even in a sort of indirect way, right? Where it's even mentioned.
Right.
But I think that, like, the way I read it was Sentovich is sort of this, you know, sort of deeply uncreative, methodical, like, plotting kind of, you know, cold advance, just like we advance to victory through the power of mathematics and just, you know, like, pure calculation, right?
He's like a Nazi.
He's like the Nazis writ large, right? Like, this just this cold, calculating, you know, flat, you know, dead inside thing, right? That only cares about achieving this victory. Dr. B is this, like, deeply mentally involved, like, creative, you know, person who can visualize the game in his mind and is sort of stifled by the uncreativity, certainly of his captors and the Gestapo, but also by Sentovich himself, right? Who's just sitting there taking his time, moving very slowly, and it drives Dr. B sort of insane at the end. So I think, like, Sentovich is sort of the embodiment of the kind of Nazi attitude towards the world, which is just this cold, calculating, uncreative, dead thing that stifles creativity and art and expression. And Dr. B is kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
And Sentovich isn't even, like, I wouldn't even give him calculating as part of, like, what he represents in the metaphor, because I think very specifically, I said this before, but the fact that he can't, I think it's very important that he can't play without the board in front of him.
Yeah.
Like, I would say myopic and purely off of this kind of, like, vitalist instinct that requires the world to be in front of him, which is definitely part of the, like, uncreative nature of his, like, core.
He's just a classic, like, he's monomaniacal, right? And this is, I think at one point the narrator kind of, I think speaking in the words, in the, you know, speaking for Zweig, right? I think the narrator is pretty clearly, like, Zweig's self-insert, I suppose, right? I kind of just read it as him.
Like, watching Europe, or at least Austria, tear itself apart. Like, I mean, I think Dr. B is also pretty obviously, like, his beloved, you know, lettered, intellectual, high-class nobility.
Right.
You know, there's a reason Dr. B is, like, working for the nobility, and, like, the sympathies are certainly kind of for the church and the old, you know, nobility and, like, the former iteration of Austria.
Yes. And you know, he says at one point, I'm trying to find it, I don't know if I highlighted it in this, but he says at one point, like, he's always been fascinated with people like this, right? Like, people who just have this intense focus on one thing and sort of one thing only, right? This kind of OCD kind of monomaniac, and which Hitler also famously was, right? Like, Hitler was very kind of you know, like that, right? Kind of sort of OCD, sort of, you know, monomaniacal in that way. So I think that
a failed artist, yeah,
also failed artist, right? For sure.
Germaphobe. Wasn't he a germaphobe?
Probably.
I think he was.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I read the metaphor at the sort of base level. The interesting
thing to me about, I think I agree with your metaphor, but I'm like trying to strip it down to like the very core, and I keep thinking about class.
Yeah.
And it is kind of like an interesting clash of the classes, and it's kind of like, I'm seeing like Nazism associated with lower class, and high intellectualism associated with like the opposite of Nazism, which I think is interesting.
I think there probably is something to that. I mean, right, like National Socialism at the beginning pitched itself as a sort of populist movement for the lower classes to escape poverty and escape you know, like their sort of the drudgery of their lives, right? That was kind of how it pitched itself in the early days. And then how it sort of rose to prominence, right? So I think that there's definitely something to that. And then I would also say, I think probably, you know, there was in Zweig some kind of bitterness about that, right? Like he was an aristocrat. He was like those were the people he palled around with, right? He was this man of letters, and I think he deeply loved that sort of high society mindset. And so there is some kind of elitism as well in Zweig.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's like, you know, it's something Zweig, I think, takes as a given as being good in sort of the face of Nazism as like the culmination of all of the ugly, Volkish kind of like, you know, blood and soil shit. and he certainly would, it would make sense that he'd be like a kind of like, yeah, classicist, elitist. And that he would just sort of be like, yeah, you know, that's not even something to be interrogated a little bit. So it does leave a somewhat strange twist on things, where it's not like all just like sympathy or like, yeah, you are drawing these kind of parallels between, you know, a peasant orphan as like the embodying symbol of the worst kind of aspects of like a brainless but somehow still effective civilizational movement like this.
Right.
Yeah, which comes across to me as like pretty dark, but also there's definitely some truth in it. Like even thinking about our own country, you know, right-wing politics can be very appealing to a lower class person. That's always kind of been the case. So it's not like I disagree with it, but it came across as like dark, and I don't necessarily like aristocratic elitism. So I was like,
yeah,
to put it on such a high horse, I was like, this is kind of off-putting to me.
Well, it's weird because, you know, obviously like Nazism, one of the most well-known sort of like evils of the world in history, but at the same time, Zweig in a way is being somewhat more conservative here, mm-hmm. in the sense that he's like, this, can we please go back to the way things were, which was like idyllic for him.
Yeah, I think Zweig just pretty much thinks that, right? He's this very like, you know, it's like return, but in a different way, right? It's like,
yeah,
it's like return, but to the like, you know, the salad days of, you know, of aristocracy, just
right,
you know, making their art and having patrons, and you know, the men of letters just, you know, trading ideas and with Freud and other writers and da 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 da. For Zweig, I do think that is kind of like the prelapsarian ideal for him, right? And that's what he so deeply lamented the loss of, was that aspect of culture, which of course that's that, like you say, Paul, that's its own sort of problematic, I think, worldview, right?
It's totally problematic. It's fucking twisted bullshit. Like, that's not the ideal society. Like you rich aristocrat missing your like fancy ballroom parties. Fuck you.
I think it's funny. Weren't the Rothschilds one of the old Vienna families?
I think so, yeah.
It's just funny to me, considering.
Because you're a conspiracy theorist.
No. But considering like Nazis online and just like how heavy that still weighs as like a, you know, narrative and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's what Zweig loved. I think you're right. But at the same time, you know, I don't think it took a particularly incisive, intelligent, perceptive person to notice something bad. But like that you certainly would want to be like, no, let's pump the brakes here and like let's rein this in, because yeah, there was a huge brain drain and like mass migration out of that region.
I mean, he had Zweig himself had his own, has had some of his books burned, right, by the Nazis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as degenerate.
Exactly. Probably confusion, because that was arguably depicting a kind of homosexual, a type of love, right, between men.
Agape. Oh, yeah. Easy burn.
Greek love. Yeah, the Nazis, that's an easy burn for the Nazis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think that there's well, good yeah, people. There's good. There's bad people on both sides.
No, I'm joking. The radical centrist take we're going for.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, he added like confusion.
Yeah.
Confusion, but like interesting quality though is that like Dr. B is a very likable person.
Dr. B is very likable. We love Dr. B.
Yeah, he kind of talks himself out of the, you know, the sympathizer position that he was clearly in a very like empathetic way, and you kind of get turned around quickly as to like what his situation is. He even almost convinced me that the hellhole he was in was potentially worse than a concentration camp, because he was like, at least there's other people.
He says that.
I think he pretty much says that, or heavily implies that.
But I mean, reading that, I was like, that seems absolutely crazy to me, dude. Like, are you really gonna say that? But I mean, Zweig wrote it so well, and he was just describing this like intense loneliness that you can't describe. It's like, even though I'm in this fancy hotel room, I talk to zero people. I hear nothing. I have nothing to do or read. It's just me in this. It's like, you know, solitary confinement.
Right.
It did remind me a lot of Dirty Snow, that segment.
Yeah.
Because of that whole, like, I do love the, like, and this was in, not Le Samurai. What was that, like, Melville, like, French New Wave movie about Vichy France, where they're all, like, there's a huge portion where they're also, like, basically imprisoned and being questioned by the Gestapo, and that scenario of House of Cards, I think, that scenario of going insane because you're being asked the same questions with minor variations for months, and keeping your stories straight and constantly having anxiety about like having contradicted yourself, like that I can have the sympathetic dread.
Oh, it sounds like hell.
It really is like one of the, like, it just sounds like, yeah, so awful. And yeah, you could see someone easily having a breakdown doing that shit.
And it also, it reminded me of the that Michael Sisko story we talked about on the Patreon recently, Matt. The anti-societies, right?
Anti-societies,
where that's just that, where the guy is just getting interrogated with these and then these interrogators just becomes obsessive over the tiniest little, you know, like they, like in that case, you know, if you want to watch this video, we talk about it more on the Patreon, but you know, the distinction between being just all right and very fine, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. It's like, so what do you mean when you said just fine, you meant you're just all right? And like, so, okay, so what's the point? And blah, blah, blah. And then he just gets his foot cut off for a totally different reason that he wasn't even expecting. Yeah.
It sounds like hell. And I think it's like, obviously you don't, that was the point, right? Like, it's not about comparing sufferings, but it's like they had variegated forms of torture, right?
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
That they applied differently to different people. And I think I really think like Zweig has a really strong handle on all of the various psychologies at play here. You know,
yes.
Like for I thought he just writes it so well. And you know, because the Dr. B's kind of description of his confinement and learning to play chess in this strange way, that's like a third of the book, if not more. It's like 35 yeah. pages out of
it's
like the 80.
Majority, yeah.
Right? So you really get into his head, and it's like it's harrowing. It's very like tense, and like you start sweating a little bit. It's very very intensely written.
And there is an implicit, I think, criticism of like the intellectual class kind of like leaving the planet to their own minds, mm-hmm. and that sort of being the very like unhelpful. So they like so that you know he still is, you know, you get the impression better than Sentovich on an intellectual level. Like he could beat him, but the fact of his solipsistic mania,
he calls it chess sickness.
You know, does read as a bit of a dig maybe at like the kind of like masturbatory, like completely theoretical, like losing sight of what's in front of you effects of like over intellectualizing things and like whatever.
Yeah,
I mean you get a critique of that too in the Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse,
mm-hmm.
where you know basically like these aloof priest classes are playing you know it's like they're gaming all the time, but the game is like this super complicated game where they've completely like intellectualized and turned into little like player tokens the entire like life and existence. Yeah. And it's just horrible shit goes on around them, and they continue to just play this game because it's like the best, you know, to them, it's the only worthwhile.
It's the only thing worth to do with their time. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think that there is definitely a sort of implicit critique of like, you know, all of this is going on in the world and you're just in the realm of the theoretical, right. You're literally just playing in your head.
You'll just get outfoxed by the more like dogged and grounded person regardless of their intellectual talents,
right?
Or not fully regardless, but you know, you'll just get brute forced essentially by somebody.
Right. Yeah, you can't take away the human element, the human element.
Well, yeah. I think it's like an anti-Manichaean, like anti-dualist sort of text is in that way as well. It's like the golden position would be to have both of these qualities,
I think chess is a perfect kind of
right
way to discuss that, right? Because chess is perfectly black and white, right? There's just the two sides,
zero sum game,
but within that, yet there's like this creativity and like infinite room for expression, right? Mm-hmm. I really like his, I just want to read a little bit from this. I like his original kind of description of chess early on. This is on page like 14 and 15. Because I think that this kind of captures what you're trying to, you know, point out here. So he says, "From my own experience, I was well aware of the mysterious attraction of the royal game, which, alone among the games devised by man, regally eschews the tyranny of chance and awards its palms of victory only to the intellect, or rather to a certain type of intellectual gift. But is it not already an insult to call chess anything so narrow as a game? Is it not also a science, an art, hovering between these categories like Muhammad's coffin between heaven and earth? A unique yoking of opposites, ancient and yet eternally new, mechanically constituted and yet an activity of the imagination alone, limited to a fixed geometric area but unlimited in its permutations, constantly evolving and yet sterile, a cogitation producing nothing, a mathematics calculating nothing, an art without an artwork, an architecture without substance, and yet demonstrably more durable in its essence and actual form than all books and works. The only game that belongs to all peoples and all eras, while no one knows what God put it on earth, while no one knows what God put it on earth to deaden boredom, sharpen the mind, and fortify the spirit. Where does it begin? Where does it end? Any child can learn its basic rules. Any amateur can try his hand at it. And yet, within the inalterable confines of a chessboard, masters unlike any others evolve. People with a talent for chess and chess alone. Special geniuses whose gifts of imagination, patience, and skill are just as precisely as apportioned as those of mathematicians, poets, and musicians, but differently arranged and combined." I just loved that. I thought it was fantastic.
I had that whole portion highlighted as well.
Yeah, you're so cool. You're good at chess.
I think it's like
the most creative game ever. It's like totally boundless.
Speaking of psychology, I think Paul's a little triggered by the story because he's sworn off chess because he lost twice.
Yeah.
No, I lost thousands of times.
But what was your?
It is true though that like you can only think of chess that way if you are good at it.
No,
I don't think so.
I
think of chess that way, and I'm not that good at it.
Like, it's, what was both of your like, what ELO or whatever your
peak ELO?
What was your number?
I think I cracked like low 2K at some point. Mm-hmm. Maybe like that's 25.
Really good. I was like 700.
Yeah,
but I'm a genuine idiot.
Well, you? Also,
I'm worse than both of you. So I mean, I'm probably like a 300.
That's only like in slow games. I can't do I can't do any game faster than like 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Those fast games were impossible.
It's so hard. I just can't. Yeah. I can't think that fast anymore.
It's a different. It's totally different. A different part of your brain with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's more about like instant pattern recognition and like that. Those fast games are so much more mechanical, right? Like there's you're just memorizing patterns and moves.
Yeah, pretty much.
But then I used to watch this streamer that was like number one in the world at bullet chess, and he was like he would play Magnus a lot too. And you can find him on YouTube. I would still watch those. They're freaking fascinating.
Oh yeah,
I have no idea what's going on. They're just playing on like line.
Yep.
And the pieces are just going so quickly and the games are just like rapid, just like they're over 30 seconds.
Yep.
And they're intense and fun to watch, even though I don't know what's happening.
Well, all those chess hustlers in like Washington Square Park, you know, they're definitely, I feel like the Dr. B style full memorization play just to get some, you know, so they can like rope some college student in.
Yeah,
like played a couple games and they can just cop like $20.
It's I want to shout out my brother, dude. When we were last in New York, he was playing one of those guys, and he was gonna win, and then he blundered and lost.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, those guys will do some dirty tricks, not cheat, but like distract you.
Very psychological.
It is a psych game. Yeah.
Well, it's like street basketball, but it's on the chessboard. Some shit talking.
Yeah, shit talking is a big part of it, which makes those games a lot more fun to watch.
They're very funny. What else? Any other passages y'all highlighted or
no, man, you got my biggie, which I was a little annoyed about because I was I'm so ready to read this.
I'm so sorry.
No, I really like this. I'm gonna say I did like the switch in the story of like, you know, it was a short story, but I like the when Dr. B started to just go through his experience in the hotel. It was like a shift in the story, and you end up going back to the game, but it was like a big chunk. Was it like 30 pages?
We mentioned that I think when you were in the bathroom. It's like big chunk of the novella is just that recollection, which I think is really effective.
And it took like an obviously a political turn, but yeah, I really loved it. It just like got darker and darker, and you got more characterization from Dr. B, and you suddenly understood exactly why he was so good at chess. I don't know. It felt kind of like a little underdog story too, like a nice little movie from the 80s could have been made out of this.
Oh, for sure. Well, I believe this was made into a movie at some point.
Oh,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I'm pretty sure this was made into or was adapted. At least once.
What's that movie with Sean Austin from like the 90s where he
I don't know,
Brodo or Sam yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. He plays like
Rudy
oh Rudy
this is like chess Rudy
yeah
chess Rudy Rudy
yeah it's Rudy. This has been this it's inspired like at least two films so yeah. Neither of which I've seen.
But yeah, I think other than that, it's a beautifully done, I think. And I think it works really well and is punchy as like this at this short length. That's kind of all I was getting.
Yeah.
You know, from it was just this really dramatized but also like palatably detached metaphor for this thing that was like, you know, and like you said, Zweig was such a sort of gentleman.
Yeah.
He would never do something so uncouth as to discuss like
politics,
pogroms or politics, right, or atrocities or whatever. And it's funny that like this is the darkest he gets.
Yeah.
And this whole situation was actually eating him alive and like caused him to commit suicide.
Yeah, I actually want to we're almost at about an hour here, actually. So I do want to come back in the Patreon segment and talk a little bit more about that style that Zweig has of like kind of detachment. And I think the way he uses perspective and who is talking to kind of layer that, because I think it's also really interesting. And then we'll take questions and do whatever else we want in the Patreon segment. We'll keep talking.
Yeah.
But before that, you're fleeing from the Nazis, Harry.
You're a savant, Harry.
You're a savant, Harry. So for those of you who are new, this is the segment of the show where we take the characters from the book we just read and put them in our in their respective Harry Potter houses. It's called We Literally Just Read Another Book.
Yes.
So don't tell us to read other books, because we just did.
Because we did. We already did it, and now we can finally do what we want to do.
All right. So I think we got, let's see, who can we do? I think there's like three.
Yeah.
I don't know if we need to do the narrator.
Easy clap.
I think we can do, maybe we could do the narrator. I don't know.
I think we get enough of the narrator. It's his perception and kind of spin on the whole thing.
Okay. All right. So let's start with McConner. The brash Scotsman.
Gryffindor.
Yeah. Okay, why?
Just like a strong, douchey Gryffindor, good at business, you know, brave, trying to stand up to the world champion.
All right.
You know, I could kind of see him as a, what's it called in Harry Potter? When you're like a wizard fighter for like an arbor?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know this.
Me neither.
I don't know this deep lore.
Damn it,
nerd!
I can't think of it. But
so Dick Gryffindor.
Yeah, Dick Gryffindor.
Okay.
A lot of Gryffindors are Dick Gryffindors.
That's true. Yeah, I can see it. All right, I like Dick Gryffindor.
Yeah.
Yeah, like confident to the point of stupidity, but it's still giving him success and
aura. Right. It's called an aura when you
work. Aura. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I remember that now. Yeah,
that's like the warriors, the wizard warriors.
They're like, they work for the like the Department of Defense wizardy.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever it's called.
Okay.
Yeah, the Dumbledore Defense Force or whatever they make in that fucking book. Yeah, the Army of Dumbledore or something.
But you're not necessarily working for Dumbledore. You're working for like the Ministry.
You're working for Raytheon.
Yeah, you're working for the FBI of the Wizarding World, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. How about, let's do the narrator next. What do you guys think about the narrator?
Ravenclaw.
I like Ravenclaw.
Yeah.
Very curious guy.
Yeah, curious.
Curious, intellectual.
Yeah, just kind of there for the ride. Like
man of letters.
On a boat.
Good vibes.
Yeah, good vibes.
Yeah.
Good vibes from this guy. Seems just sort of like the right amount of engaged and intrigued by all personalities involved. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's pretty easy. Centovich.
Slytherin, easy clap. He's like, if Crab was a at chess.
I'm not gonna argue with that at all.
That's actually really pretty good. I think that's a good description.
Why not Boyle?
They're the same.
same person.
Same.
All right. Yeah, I buy that 100%.
Yeah, I like that. He's a Slytherin.
Yeah.
He loves success and money, and he's
right, personal gain and
personal just, gain and putting other people down.
He slithered his way into the chess world,
mm-hmm.
and he was like, I'll make fucking money, and that's it.
Yeah.
I don't even get it. I don't even get what I'm doing.
Just move the pieces and win.
Yeah, just move them until you win. It's fucking easy. That's like the guys, the like the stock market guys who like, you really like boil down what they're saying. They're like, dude, you just watch the line go up and down. And you just put money or take money out, and then yeah. you make money. Yeah. Like what?
Yeah. Dr. B.
I think Dr. B is like a incredibly puff, maybe.
Puff, interesting.
I don't know. I mean, I'm having a tough time with this one too. I think
it's pretty. He's pretty griff when he's in captivity.
No, he
mental strength, mental fortitude.
Sort of. I mean, he has chest fever.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he got lucky. He got chest fever, right before he got chest fever,
he was going to spill the beans.
He was going to spill the beans. That's true.
He actually did. He like spilled the beans, but the guard didn't hear him. Right.
That's right.
I did it. Come back. Right. It was me.
That's right.
Here's all their names. All their money's here.
Yeah.
So maybe like a I'm going to say he's a Hufflepuff actually still.
Okay.
He's got a Ravenclaw rising, Hufflepuff Ravenclaw rising, or okay. Yeah, that's what I'll go with.
I'm gonna do similar. I'm gonna say Ravenclaw with Hufflepuff rising because I think it would take a unique person to in that situation, like not any person that just was in that situation that got a chess book would be able to do what he did. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if I was in that situation, I would become like decent at chess, but not the world fucking champion. Like you know what I mean? I wouldn't.
Yeah.
He's got some chops.
He had to really be interested in that book, too.
Yes. Well, he had to, or else he was going to lose his mind.
And then he did lose his mind, chest fever.
True.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I'm smart enough to get chest fever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if it might have taken like 10 years for me in that situation to get that good, you know? Maybe 1,000.
Yeah.
Let's be real, 10,000.
100 million.
100 million years.
Infinity Google.
Googleplex. Yeah, I like this. Some mix of Ravenclaw, Hufflepuff. I do think he's got a little griff in him. But
yeah. I think it's an incidental aspect of his loyalty as opposed to his bravery.
All right, that's fair. I'm with it. I sign up for that. All right. Did you guys have any cool words from this book that you found? Any good words? I have a few.
Oh, I forgot.
I got one.
You can do two for me.
All right, Matt, what's yours?
Mine is...
Oh, this is where we find a word that we didn't know from the book, or a cool word.
That could be used in Scrabble.
That's how we started, yeah. But it doesn't have to be.
Okay.
Yeah, just cool. That's it. Mine is Buren.
Ah, that was one of mine, too.
All right.
What does that mean again?
A steel tool used for engraving in copper or wood. It looks like a little needle pipette.
Nice.
And I guess you can scrape, you know, fine designs or text onto those materials.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Buren?
Buren. Burin. Pretty easy Scrabble word, too. Or, you know.
That's a good Wordle word. Burin. Burin. Five letters.
Yeah, I don't know. Wordle never really goes there in terms of esotericism, but...
No, it's a good word to use for a guest, though, to like... You know,
oh, true. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, that's good, yeah. Okay, mine is... My other one is pensum.
Pencil.
Pencil, yeah. I'd never heard that word before, dude. Pencil. What is a pencil? No.
we're just so stupid.
That would be so funny if one of us just like said like the dumbest word.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, so there's a cat in this cat.
Yeah, cat. Yeah. Pencil. Probably never. That's new.
Probably.
I heard this cool word. There's this cool word in this book. It's P-A-R. Yeah, probably. No,
for that reason.
No, pensum, P-E-N-S-U-M, which is sort of, I couldn't find like a hard definition. It seems like sort of archaic, but I'm pretty sure it means like a punishment or like a task that you would be assigned to do as punishment for something. Yeah.
Like, so think like, on this. Like, think on what
like,
you did.
Like if a teacher made you write something on the board like 100 times, that would be a pensum.
Oh, I like that word. Yeah.
And you wouldn't use a pencil for that. You'd use chalk.
No, you use chalk.
Yeah. What is that? Spell it.
What is chalk?
What the fuck are you saying?
So yeah, those are the words from the cool book. Cool words from the book. It is also a cool book.
It is a cool book.
So okay, that leaves one thing, only one thing to do, and that's to score this baby up on a scale of 1 to 5.
All right. I liked this a lot. I think we mentioned this in the episode before, but like, I've grown to appreciate word economy and brevity.
Yeah.
And like complex things being packed in a simple way that doesn't ever cease to like exude that complexity and cause people to think. This was one of those kind of stories for me. I thought a little bit of Third Reich by Roberto Bolaño.
Came up last episode too.
Yeah, more for the posthumous thing, but for me it was like the actual like narrative. So I thought this book was really good. I had a good time reading it, and I'm gonna go ahead and give it a 3.4.
Nice.
Whoa,
that's kind of low.
Is it?
I don't know. I thought I was expecting higher based on the way you were talking about it. Yeah, what did you not like about it? Let's talk about that.
I guess it is low. I could actually, yeah. I'll bump it up to like a 3.6 though.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, I thought it was a very like deft way to describe what we've like sort of drawn out in the discussion, which is like a fairly not, you know, not simple in like the content of it, but like the metaphors at play were describing something that at least to me felt obvious. That wasn't a negative though.
It was just like,
it's like these sides of like the human mind in conflict, like, you know, backlit by the like historical context of like Nazism and the fading of a aristocratic nobility based structure in Austria, you know, like to do that in 80 pages or however long this was, 60? No, 80.
Yeah, like 83, 85.
83 pages is impressive, but yeah. You know, like, I don't know. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I actually didn't find it to be that clear, concise, honestly. Like, I thought that Zweig,
yeah,
is that how we're pronouncing it? I thought that he was kind of exploring and floundering around a little bit with his metaphors. And I think the most interesting part of the book for me is the like his actual class beliefs coming out. And I don't even, and I think that something interesting about that for me is like, I'm not even sure if he knew exactly what he was doing when they did surface. Like, we talked it through and they came out during our discussion, but the core of the story to me is like low class right wing politics and his belief of high class or aristocracy being the good and being like positive politics, left wing politics. And it's not necessarily something I believe, but I think it's interesting to me that that came out during the story that he wrote about chess. It's weird. But in terms of like it actually hitting very hard, I didn't really feel that in very many instances, aside from when Dr. B was like explaining his captivity. I thought that was powerful. But overall, I just thought it was like, oh, this is a cute little novella. It's like a almost a book. It's like a kid trying to get on a roller coaster and he's 2 inches short. so I it's pretty not mediocre for me, but it's like forgettable.
Short bad. I think Paul's saying short bad.
Yeah, I don't know. I
I like one. I like like a single man is a great example, I think, of like a great size, very concise. And I love that book.
Yeah, or book
like,
fucking rules.
Yeah.
Even The Mountain Lion. Was that true?
No, Mountain Lion's like almost 300 pages, I think. Oh, or 250, so maybe two 250-ish.
So I think A Single Man's a better example. Just like a good solid length. I felt like every structure and every word mattered. And I didn't really get that feeling from this one. I felt like a little floundery and written with a lot of emotion. So, but I'm actually going to give it a similar score, though. I'm at like 3.2.
Nice. Yeah, I really liked this. I thought it was really smart. And a lot, like Matt said, there was a lot packed into a short. And it worked on a lot of levels. Like, it has the metaphorical stuff and the context of Zweig's life and the Nazis at the time really add a lot. But it's also like, it's just I see why people would want to adapt this into a film. It's just interesting.
Yeah, right?
It's just
that's
a cool,
true.
It's just a cool story. Like, it's very interesting about a guy and who challenges the world champion because he was captured and learned chess. It's just cool. You know, it's just kind of fucking cool as a little story. But I think the context just makes it even better. I could see people being like, I feel like it maybe a little repetitive at points. I could see people or like Paul said, there were moments where maybe it was like unhelpfully verbose in some descriptions and stuff like that, but I think that's just Zweig's style, and it worked for me. I really enjoyed it, and I want to read more Zweig now because I also liked,
oh for sure,
I also liked Confusion. I'm gonna give it a 4.1. I thought it was quite good.
Well,
nice.
Yeah,
you just love chess and I don't.
So I do let it. I do love chess, and in the Patreon segment, I am gonna talk about some chess nerd shit that's interesting to me, sure. Also in this book. So yeah.
Oh yeah, Zweig was one of those people who definitely was like, I'm not trying to no purple prose for me. I'm pretty sure was one of the like things he was thinking about, at least, not maybe always doing, but you know.
What's purple prose?
Like flowery, yeah. A lot of 10-cent words, complicated sentences that go on for a really long time, like I think he was striving for clarity.
I agree.
Faulkner. Well, when was Faulkner around? During kind of his time, right?
Faulkner?
Yeah. No, it was, I mean, he would have been alive, I think, but like
not writing yet.
Faulkner was probably oh fuck, this is embarrassing.
Faulkner died in
60.
I thought he was writing there in the 40s.
He died in 62.
62,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, he was writing throughout this.
He wrote for like three decades, I think.
Most of his shit was in the like 20s and 30s, though, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which Zweig, too, wrote during that time period, obviously. So, yeah, they wrote around the same time.
I guess you're right, yeah.
See, that was good. I had a good job just now, and you guys were trying to disprove me.
No, I wasn't.
No, I pressed F to doubt, and then I was corrected.
Chat for Faulkner.
Yeah.
Yeah, big F. And Zweig.
Yeah.
And
well, cool. That was a chess story that we talked about.
That was it.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show and you want to hear us talk about more shit and the book and questions and our personal lives, patreon.com/spinecrackers, where we put all of the full episodes that are longer than just the regular.
Yeah.
And other videos.
Yeah, we're back.
So if this was helpful or enjoyable to you in any way, and you appreciate this kind of, I hesitate to say work,
content.
But content, yeah, easy, the catch-all phrase.
Smash the subscribe button.
Consider supporting.
Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I guess that's important. People say,
yeah, that's a freebie. And
if you leave a review on Apple Podcasts, we will read it on the podcast.
That's true. We've done that.
But from now on, we'll do every single one. Unless you swear at us.
Unless it's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, if it's bad, we'll read it too.
That's true.
We'll defend ourselves.
Yeah. I love defending myself.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Thanks.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Yeah, after the jump.